This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and since you find us on the podcast, we know you are discerning listeners. Let's get to it. Here's today's show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And this is going to be an hour about hope, although it's not going to feel that way in some of our conversations. From the terror scars in Oklahoma, from the bombing 2 decades ago, the daunting challenges in governing the world's largest democracy, India, and what it looks like to get close to the brutality in northern Nigeria, where the Islamist ISIS impersonator Boko Haram has managed to terrorize people but to do little else. Since 2009, the Nigerian government has struggled against the power of Boko Haram to taunt the government, temporarily seizing territory and terrorizing the public through bombings, beheadings, and abductions, like the hundreds of schoolgirls kidnapped from a government school in the town of Chibok a year ago. Despite receiving the attention of the world for a time, the girls have never been found or rescued. Nigeria's new president, General Muhammadu Buhari, has promised to eradicate Boko Haram. And in our new partnership with Vice News, correspondent Kaj Larson takes us to the front lines of the Nigerian offensive, a place where few reporters have made it, even if they have wanted to brave the danger from both sides. Larson's new documentary for Vice is called The War Against Boko Haram, a war Larson says that at first glance in northern Nigeria, it looks like Boko Haram is winning.
Much of northern Nigeria has been abandoned, and that's why you see these 1.5 million refugees that have, you know, fled to Chad or Cameroon or some internally displaced people in Maiduguri itself.
And here's a sense of the terror and the deep just sort of feeling of absolute fear that people who not too long ago were just citizens in Nigeria.
They attacked because they targeted populations. They are targeting populations, gatherings of people. Right. Wherever there is a crowd, that's their target. They slaughter people like animals, which is not part of Islamic doctrine.
This is not an interview that I set up. I literally was walking down the street and people were grabbing me, wanting to tell me their stories of Boko Haram. I had just come out of a doorway from an interview with another family when Elijah said, "Stop, please, I must tell you." It turns out that his brother had been killed by Boko Haram in a terrorist attack and his son had been killed by Boko Haram in a terrorist attack. And then 2 days later, after that interview, another market that we subsequently went to was attacked, 54 people killed by a suicide bombing. So again, I was shocked at how invasive and how much Boko Haram had affected life in northern Nigeria.
And the impression you get from your reporting is that not only is Boko Haram without a political mission of any kind that you can discern, but they're also extraordinarily systematic about the way they go about killing.
Most of these young men ended up killing their parents. Their parents, their families, their friends. They have a list. They go one after another.
Now, that's Ismail Alpha Abdul Rahim, who's a journalist who is actually working in there. I mean, consider the bravery of that individual. Who is that person even filing for?
Right. So Ismail is a local journalist, and he was operating as our fixer. He is kind of the go-to fixer in the region. He's like a phenomenal person, a phenomenal source, and also has been living under the conditions of Boko Haram. He took us to the birthplace of Boko Haram.
Does he discern any program, any mission, any political agenda of Boko Haram that has any clarity to the people of Nigeria?
John, I think what you're intimating in your question is exactly right. That as far as I could discern, there is no real agenda other than to the sort of rhetorical statement of establishing an Islamic caliphate in northern Nigeria. Now, I will tell you that for the people I talk to, that mission does not resonate. And, you know, the campaign of terror and the campaign of violence certainly did not ingratiate Boko Haram to the local populace in terms of ideology. Mostly this was an organization that was kidnapping people, that was scaring people, and that was terrorizing people.
And we should say that while Boko Haram has no quarter in any moral sense whatsoever and has no reason to carry out the violence that they're carrying out. Certainly the context in which Boko Haram arrives is a very corrupt Nigerian government where resources, natural resources, oil resources are not distributed in a way that can be seen as even remotely fair to the populace. So there's a huge cynicism about the Nigerian government. Now that there is a new election and a new leader in Nigeria, is any of that likely to change?
Well, you hit upon the systemic causes of Boko Haram perfectly, right? What ultimately has created the environment that allows an organization like Boko Haram to flourish is this massive inequality, right? The resource inequality between the South and the North, those are the latent conditions that created Boko Haram. The change of government is always sort of an opportunity for a new horizon. But as you know, the kinetic portion of this fight is the easiest portion. Going and killing a bunch of Boko Haram fighters, like, that can be figured out. The hard part is to address these really systemic conditions in terms of resource allocation, in terms of education, the hard work of statecraft.
Which has yet to be done in Nigeria. I'm going to play a bit of an interview that you did with someone named Jeremiah Friday, who's a private, a ranger in the 72nd Mobile Strike Force, one of the government soldiers who's attempting to liberate northern Nigeria.
When the Boko Haram started, they were like burning churches. So people thought they were Muslims. What are these people? They fight the Christian, they fight the Muslim. So nobody knew about them. We believe they are just, they're devils. They don't have heart.
And here in your unit, you have Muslims and Christians, right?
We love each other. The Muslim pray, the Christian sit around, watch them as buddy buddy, no problem. The Muslim and the Christian, we are all good. We are friends, brothers.
Is there a sense of camaraderie and unity among the Nigerian forces? Because there are a lot of stories pre-election that people were just as scared of the Nigerian military as they were of Boko Haram at certain points in this conflict.
And understandably so. The historical context of this latest offensive is not necessarily a positive story. In fact, there are many people who would impugn it as the latest offensive as an election ploy to re-elect President Goodluck Jonathan. That obviously didn't happen. And there have been significant documentation of human rights abuses and atrocities by the Nigerian military. The latest catalyst for Boko Haram, whether the real inflection point in terms of the violence of Boko Haram, was 2009, when there was an extrajudicial killing of Muhammad Yusuf, the founder of Boko Haram, right? That led the law of unintended consequences to the takeover of Boko Haram by the way more radical, way more violent, way more bloodthirsty Shekau, who's the current leader of Boko Haram. So yes, all of that historical context of the Nigerian military, even back in 2009, that is relevant. However, that being said, I think almost everybody that I spoke with was extraordinarily supportive of the idea of ridding northern Nigeria of Boko Haram. That sort of campaign of random terror and the kidnappings of the Chibok schoolgirls, all of those acts that have put kind of Boko Haram on the public radar, those are all real and they're all felt on the ground by the citizens who are trying to live their lives in Nigeria.
What do people believe has happened to those girls?
I think the first thing that I want to say about the Chibok schoolgirls is that is what mostly put Boko Haram on the international radar, right? People were sort of vastly unaware in the social media campaign, sort of an extraordinary, unprecedented viral campaign, but it also represented the asymptotic limits of what some people, you know, describe as hashtag activism. The meta effect of that campaign was almost zero. At the end of the day, it takes boots on the ground to go after these guys. Even that has proven to be fairly ineffective in terms of this very tactical element of rescuing the Chibok girls. Most Nigerians now, and the sort of collective intel from both the Nigerian side and the Nigerian military side and civilian side, is that the Chibok girls are now Chibok moms. It's been more than 9 months. The vast majority of them have been married off to Boko Haram fighters. They've found a few of them as far north as Mauritania and Mali who have been married off to different fighters, or they've been transited through networks and are now married to Tuareg fighters. So they're scattered. They're dispersed. There are some present in the Sambisa forest, but I think it's important to also state that there is going to be no extraordinary dramatic rescue where we find 200 schoolgirls in a warehouse.
You served in Afghanistan.
Yes. I'm an OEF veteran.
Right. And with the Marines, with the Army?
I'm a naval officer. Navy SEAL.
Navy SEAL. Mm-hmm. Okay. How do you resist the urge? You know, if you've got Boko Haram in your sights, to grab an AK-47 and do your duty.
Well, it's just too hard to balance the camera and the gun at the same time. So it just doesn't work.
That's not a good answer. And your mom is not going to want to hear that answer either. I mean,
I made a decision in 2005 when I got off of active duty that I was going to trade my gun for a camera. And at first, it was actually very difficult for me personally. I went from being the man in the arena to the man covering the man in the arena.
With this useless piece of junk called a camera.
Right. And what I started to learn over time is that I was still serving. I was just serving out of uniform, and I was serving in a different capacity. And my role and my job now is to really inform people as to what's happening. And over time, and this could be self-rationalization or justification, over time I've come to believe that that's actually more powerful than any individual action that I could do. It's a little bit of a cliche on the pen is mightier than the sword, but I've come to believe that that's true.
Kaj Larson is a Vice News correspondent, the only Western journalist to embed on the front lines in northern Nigeria in the fight against Boko Haram. To see photos of Kaj Larson's reporting and for a link to his full documentary, visit thetakeaway.org. I suppose we think of terrorism almost every day in America, but it wasn't always so. On a promising spring day, April 19th, 1995, I ran over to ABC News anticipating a perhaps long lunch in the welcome daffodil warmth, and was told to grab the bag in my office where the on-camera clothes were always kept and to go downstairs to a fleet of cars taking a team to the airport. Where are we going? I asked. Oklahoma City, bomb blast, terrorist attack, biggest thing you can imagine. Get going, a producer said.
It's just absolutely incredible. I mean, one floor after another pancaked on top of each other.
Law enforcement officials have stepped up security at federal buildings around the country. Police say at least two
bombs. There was a car bomb explosion around 9 o'clock. They believe the car was parked on the north side of that building.
Back then, there was no way to click up a news story and a picture on a cell phone screen, so I had no idea what we were heading into. I first saw the collapsed Murrah Federal Building with its dangling floors and front sheared off when I arrived in the city. There were nasty thunderstorms, dark clouds. They made everything look like an industrial complex, a mining operation on some other planet, floodlights, ambulances, the smell of fire and dirt in your nostrils, cranes, helicopters. We fanned out across the city. I went with a camera crew to a nearby hospital where doctors and nurses trained to treat survivors anxiously awaited arrivals. But at this ER, few had been saved. There seemed to be only one survivor when we got there, a little girl, not badly injured, but sedated. She was found in the rubble of the Murrah building hours earlier. At one point, an exhausted woman stumbled in. She'd been to every hospital looking for her child. After some joyful confusion, she recognized this living little girl as her daughter. "My child, my child, my child," she kept saying. The doctors calmed her down, assured her that her child was all right, and this mother wandered over to us in a daze. "Was your little girl at the daycare center?" I asked, because we had managed to learn that the truck bomb was detonated right next to the Murrah building's first-floor employee child care facility. "I dropped her there this morning," she said. "I've been all over town to every hospital. So many dead. It's a miracle," she said. She paused and looked up at us and realized we were reporters. "Do you know how far she was?" she whispered. "From the bomb?" "It's hard to say," I said awkwardly, "but if she was at that daycare center, it was probably like from here to there, 30 feet away. 300 nearby buildings were damaged or destroyed from the force of that bomb blast that morning. 168 people died." The cameraman rolled as the mother collapsed in a chair with her face in her hands, dripping with tears. My child," she kept whispering. That footage never made it into our ABC coverage, but I've never forgotten the face of that mom and her little miracle on April 19th, 1995. We We want to take you now to Oklahoma City to hear the words of the people who witnessed that day in April, the Oklahoma City bombing, a radio documentary co-produced by KGOU and KOSU in Oklahoma. Excerpts that will air this weekend.
I was in the doorway of my office talking with colleagues when all of a sudden we heard the boom. Everything caved in. The building shook so badly you couldn't stand, and I was buried in rubble.
Susan Urbach was a government official in her office across the street from where the bomb went off.
When everything was still, I had all this stuff all over me. Things dangling from the ceiling, rubble in the hallway, smoke filling the place. So, of course, we thought it was our building. Got out on the street. Everybody seemed to be covered in blood. It was like you could have had a piece of dust impacted in your skin and you bled from it. My injuries were lacerations. I had close to 4 feet worth of stitches. I think I was in surgery about 4 hours. I needed a little bit of care after the hospital, so I went home with a friend who, he was a doctor and she was a nurse, and they could kind of help me with all the wounds because I sort of, you know, it was not good for a while. And then I went to St. Gregory's, to the monastery there, and I slept for 3 days. That's all I did. So I went to be with the monks in the prayers and just kind of being in a sanctuary. And for me to be very centered is centered around my faith. Destruction, evil, it comes in this huge, dramatic incident like the bombing. But healing doesn't come that way. Healing comes slowly. And so that helped me walk through the process, always looking, understanding that healing didn't come the next day, but that it would come over a period of time, but I needed to be aware of it.
Susan Urbach, remembering a day that forever changed her life. Here's Kevin McCullough, a police officer and first responder in Oklahoma City.
I didn't really hear the explosion. I had no idea what I was in store for. When I pulled on the site, the street was covered with glass and debris. The first thing that I really noticed was the nitrates in the air, you know, from the bomb, and I just remember people running. I went in and out of the building. I didn't observe any live victims. I describe April 19th, 1995, as one of the worst things that's ever happened to me in my life, but also one of the best things, because as I was down here working in the rescue efforts with the bombing, unbeknownst to me, my wife was in the hospital giving birth to my youngest son, Jordan. When I got home, I expected someone to be there, and they were at the hospital. I'd really seen the worst of what could happen that day, but also you see the best in people. You see people pull off the highway, rush into the building, help carry victims, help carry bodies, help direct traffic. So you see the worst of what men can do, but you see also what the best people have in them. We're reminded every year on Jordan's birthday that it's not only his birthday, but it's a day in Oklahoma history. It was such a devastating event, and we continue to hear the stories. Someone just dropping off paperwork, someone trying to help somebody with their Social Security, you know, the children in the daycare. And it's just heartbreaking still, 20 years later. I fully believe that children got extra hugs many days after that. It's very difficult for those of us that responded down here on that day to talk about. But when we do, it's with respect.
That was Kevin McCullough, one of the voices from the radio documentary That Day in April, the Oklahoma City Bombing, a co-production of KGOU and KOSU in Oklahoma. Please visit KGOU.org and KOSU.org to hear the full radio documentary. You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. I'm at Jay Hockenberry, and I do try to reply to as many tweets as I can. Thanks for choosing us to listen to. Our motto is share what you know, and there are plenty of ways of doing that. Check us out. Take part in the show. There's more at thetakeaway.org.
I'm going to give Sonny listen, talking lessons, boxing lessons, and falling down lessons.
Leave my sister and my daughter.
Because I bloody well stammer.
None of you will get my kingdom. I leave you nothing that I wish to play.
I don't know what we're yelling about.
I'm glad that clip is back. My sister or my daughter. I love that one. That's my great. It's Friday, of course, time to talk movies with Christian Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway and co-host of the Movie Date podcast with Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, also co-host of the Movie Date podcast. Welcome, guys.
Hi, John.
Thanks, John.
So I guess if they can make a movie about a guy falling in love with an operating system voice, right, they can make a movie about people who are just texting each other, and it's a horror movie, and Unfriended is the name. Let's have a clip.
Hey, guys. What are you guys doing?
Hey, Mitch, who's your buddy?
Who is that?
I just tried to hang up on him.
Can you get rid of this person?
I don't know.
Is this here the whole time?
This is probably a glitch.
Well, the glitch just typed.
Who is doing this? This is Laura's account.
Who would hack into a dead girl's account?
Maybe it's Laura.
Laura, the lurker. So does this scare you, Kristen?
It did actually scare me. And more interestingly, it intellectually had my brain the whole time. This is a movie where you're just looking at one computer screen. We have half a dozen kids who are all Skyping each other. They're G-chatting. They're on their Facebook pages. We have all their different screens open. We see that they're doing Spotify music selections. And while all of this is happening, there are bad things happening because it's the one-year anniversary of the suicide of their friend Laura, and Laura killed herself after being cyberbullied. So all of this stuff kind of plays into the storyline. It's a little scary, but it's also just very brain-consuming, very fascinating.
Filmmaking, would we call this?
You know, I would almost call it DJing. I mean, you've got this, and you've got different windows going on. You've got text on the screen. People are multitasking. Half the time, your heroine is being played by an actress, and half the time, she's just a cursor on the screen trying to close a window or open a window. You wouldn't think that would be that interesting to watch, but it's actually really effective. The whole movie takes place on her screen. You never cut away from the screen, and it unfolds in real time. I think something really creative and different has just been done with this movie. I really liked it a lot.
Was anyone watching in the theater, or were they just looking at their own screens?
But it brings up the question of how people will watch this movie. It might be even scarier if you were watching it on your own computer, right?
Well, that's fascinating. You've convinced me. All right, our movie number two here, Monkey Kingdom. We actually had Jane Goodall here in the studio earlier this week. This is her sort of she's kind of the producer.
She's the Disney nature ambassador.
Disney nature ambassador.
She goes on site when these are being made, and she is the ambassador to the public about what these movies are about.
But the narrator here is Tina Fey.
What is that?
It's furry. About the size of a langur.
Do you speak monkey?
Dude, what are you?
It likes being groomed.
So this is a nature film.
It is, but I just have to say that these are so far and away better than like the Mutual of Omaha things you had to watch on Sunday afternoons as a kid.
You had to watch those.
Well,
maybe we should talk more about that.
What else is on TV? Nothing else is on TV. It's the early 80s. But these are so well done. There's a narrative thread. We see a real family of monkeys. We see things unfolding in a way where you get very attached to the characters. I just love this. I thought it was delightful.
There's actually a story here about a little girl monkey sort of making it in the real world.
Yes, she's making it. She's got a baby, and she's working her way up from the low caste system to the higher branches, if you will. Really great story.
All right, the bad, awful movie is Paul Blart, Mall Cop 2. Two words to say about this, Rafer?
Not funny, but kind of sweet, just like the first one. It's really just a complete rehash from top to bottom of the very first movie. Right. I think if you like Kevin James.
It's not toxic. There might be some laughs. And on the podcast, Kristen?
We have our extended Oscar Isaac interview. We played a little bit of him last week on air, and now we have the full one on the podcast.
Kristen Meinzer, Rafer Guzman, culture producer for The Takeaway, film critic for Newsday, co-hosts of the Movie Date podcast. Have a great weekend, guys.
You too, John.
You too, John.
Friday. Time for your Friday Five with Sean Ramaswamy, host of Sideshow, a Studio 360 podcast about art you don't see in museums. Sean, of course, has the brilliant insight that there are only five cool things on the internet at any given time. What is that about? Five things?
Because I didn't have time for 10, and one's not a party.
But one is?
Number one is, what does this song have in common with this song?
That would be nothing.
Close to nothing. They're both technically instrumental songs that charted in the Billboard Top 10 over the course of the past 50 years. The first one was Harlem Shake. The second one was Kenny G. And this week, Medium put together a list of 50 songs that charted in the top 10 that were all instrumentals over the past 50 years. And it's really amazing to see these songs all kind of hang out together, from the Harlem Shake to the Star Wars theme song to the Hawaii Five-O theme song to Kenny G. All of our favorites are there, John.
Are they mashed together?
No, unfortunately not.
Number two.
We live in New York.
Yep.
Lots of apartment buildings.
Yep.
Some of them create really interesting spaces between apartment buildings. You can lay down between two apartment buildings, look up, and see the sky framed by the perimeter of apartment buildings.
Wait a minute. So you two want me to lie down in between two buildings and stare up into space?
Into space. You'll see in New York, you'll see like four stars. It's kind of weak because there's too much light pollution.
Yeah.
But a French artist this week, he drew illustrations within those spaces. And they're really delightful. He essentially drew characters hanging out and living between the spaces between buildings.
So the buildings are like the frame in the museum, and the sky itself is this sort of canvas medium.
You really get me, John. You
got to
check them out at thetakeaway.org. They're lovely. The nicest thing I saw online this week.
Number three.
Number three, the strangest promotional video for Sizzler from their relaunch in 1991 was unearthed by Esquire this week.
Sizzler is the one.
Sizzler arrived in 58, but in 91 they wanted to become America's restaurant. So this video's got baseball, it's got hairspray, it's got buffets, it's got kissing, it's got lip licking, a sailor, it's got an extramarital affair. It's all here, John, in a 4-minute Sizzler promotional video.
And Esquire just found it and just puts it up there.
I think it was on YouTube, and they were just like, hey, look at this, guys. And what a treat. What a treat.
Number four.
Yep. Number four. Let's hear some music. Did you hear that faint tapping on top of that Rush's Tom Sawyer?
Yeah.
That is a tiny little puppet the size of a water bottle playing along to Neil Peart's amazing drumming in Tom Sawyer. It's a video of this guy basically manning a tiny little puppet who's playing one of the best drummers in the world's best song. And
Does the puppet come close to the real drumming?
He's like on point. You can't really hear
because
he's playing on a cymbal the size of a quarter. But it's a beautiful thing to watch at thetakeaway.org on the internet.
Makes me think there should be like a Whiplash movie for puppet drummers.
I would watch it.
I would watch that. Yeah. Number five.
Number five. It wouldn't be a week on the internet without a great mashup. This week we got Vanessa Carlton's 1,000 Miles from the 90s with DJ Snake featuring Lil Jon's Turn Down for What from a few years ago. Both of those videos have really intense and beautiful energy and in completely different ways. And the guy who mashed up the songs also mashed up the videos. So it's a great audio and video experience.
Great thing. Now, if this five isn't enough for me this weekend, could I find a sixth on my own?
There's a podcast called Sideshow that you should check out.
Oh, yeah. What's on that? I've heard of that.
This week, it's the story of a 25-year-old kid working at a mall in Seattle who convinced Billy Idol to play his birthday party for free.
See, I was thinking like a 5-year-old or something who convinced Billy Idol.
It's true.
So it's always a bit of a nostalgia trip, a little bit of a kind of a down memory lanes or...
And in a way, it's a story about how the internet can make anything happen.
That's your Friday Five from Sean Ramaswamy, host of Sideshow, a Studio 360 podcast about the kind of art you don't see in museums, and Billy Idol sometimes.
Your check is in the mail. Thank you.
Here's something to take with you today and brag all weekend if you like, for at least one day anyway. You can walk around knowing the answer to this question. Who holds the record for most people wearing a Cat in the Hat hat at one time? Answer, the students at St. Elizabeth Catholic School in Rockville, Maryland. They're going for the Guinness Book of World Records today. The current record is held by Armstrong Elementary School in Highland Park, Texas. Last year, they got 726 people to wear the distinctive red and white striped hats. St. Liz's students are going for 727 today. But if you go to Amazon and order in the next 7 hours and 58 minutes and choose Saturday delivery, it will cost you about $9,464 to get 728 hats, more or less, and outdo Rockville. Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. And if you want to outdo the Rockville folks, you better send us a picture to prove it. You can ask me anything on Twitter every day. I take your questions, sometimes your complaints. I do my best to get back to you personally. You can tweet your questions to me at Jay Hockenberry. And if you want to take The Takeaway with you, subscribe to our podcast. You can find us on iTunes. Take us with you on your commute home from work. Tomorrow you get our Weekender podcast featuring an extended interview with Jane Goodall, who joined us in the studio this week. You can get our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.